the headlines, reports coming out of Myanmar say at least 16 people have been killed during fresh violent protests against the ruling junta. A row over the coronavirus vaccine exports in Europe escalates as France accuses the UK of blackmail over the issue. Clashes erupt in Bristol between British police and demonstrators opposing a government bill giving police new powers to restrict protests. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, at least 16 people have been killed as fresh clashes erupt between Myanmar's security forces and anti-coup protesters. Seven of the victims were killed in the country's commercial capital, Yangon. About a dozen were also injured after troops opened fire at the protesting crowd outside a police station there. Nine people were killed in similar protests elsewhere across Myanmar. The country has been in turmoil since the army toppled de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi from power in a coup on February the 1st. Security forces have used tear gas, rubber bullets, and live rounds against anti-coup protesters. So far, more than 200 people have been killed in the anti-coup unrest. Police in Bangladesh say five people have been killed during a violent demonstration against a visit by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Officials say four protesters were shot dead at Hatazari on Friday. Another protester was killed in Brahmanbaria after police opened fire at demonstrators. Clashes also erupted between police and protesters in the capital, Dhaka, where police fired rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse the crowd. The Friday protests were the latest in a series of demonstrations across Bangladesh to oppose Modi's visit to the country. Modi is visiting Bangladesh on the 50th anniversary of its independence from Pakistan. Bangladeshis accuse him of inciting religious tensions and anti-Muslim violence in India. After detaining hundreds of Rohingya refugees in Jammu region, India has arrested dozens more in the capital, New Delhi. As our correspondent Munawar Zaman reports, the refugee community is in utter panic and despair as many fear about their fate.
Indian police raided and detained a family in refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi. Members of the community say the police detained a family of six without any reasons, giving them no chance of even having their breakfast. The whole community is terrified, and panic has gripped the entire camp about their fate. There is an uneasy calm and a sense of fear in this refugee camp after dozens were detained in recent weeks. Now people are more fearful, anticipating their turn, which they say is inevitable after years of vicious campaigns calling for their expulsion from India. This refugee, who did not want it to be named, says police and law enforcement agencies frequently visit their camps and ask for their details. He says the visits are more frequent since last few weeks.
We are all terrified. It looks like our legs are broken and we are just alive. Since the Indian government has started detaining our members of our community, the whole camp is gripped in fear. We can't even sleep. We are burdened to everyone and no one cares about us. We are refugees. We came here to save our lives, to save our children. And we are grateful India gave us refuge since years.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different states of India.
Where are we being detained? If we have a problem for India, let them send us to some other country, wherever they feel we are safe. We are already dead, since we belong to nowhere. Now this detention issue is killing us every day and night. We left our country to save our lives. And in India we found peace, despite hardships.
Rights groups have urged India to halt any deportation plan, saying conditions in Myanmar are not conducive. They say the Indian government should uphold its international obligations and protect those in need of refuge within its borders, saying India has hosted refugees from many countries since decades, but adopted an aggressive approach towards Rohingya Muslims in particular. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
An overwhelming majority of UN member states have demanded action to be taken to ensure equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines for all people worldwide. Some 180 of the 193 UN members issued a declaration voicing deep concern over what they called uneven distribution of coronavirus vaccines across the world, both among and within countries. They highlighted that many countries do not yet have access to vaccines, demanding global cooperation to increase the production and distribution of vaccines at regional and global levels. This comes as the World Health Organization has criticized what it calls inequity in the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. Figures show more than half of the vaccines injected globally have been administered in high-income countries, accounting for only 16% of the global population. France has accused Britain of blackmail over the coronavirus vaccine exports amid a growing row over jab supplies in Europe.
We cannot deal this way and play blackmail insofar as we wanted to vaccinate without stopping for the first dose, and now we find ourselves a bit handicapped for the second dose. Europe does not have to pay the cost of these policies.
French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian called on the European Union to control exports of the AstraZeneca vaccine. He expressed hope that the EU and the UK can reach an agreement so that the British-Swedish AstraZeneca company can fulfill its vaccine deliveries. Vaccination programs have been sluggish across Europe. The EU blames pharmaceutical companies for inability to deliver the promised doses. The bloc has warned to ban AstraZeneca vaccines exports to provide the EU with the required doses. Violent clashes have once again broken out in the British city of Bristol as police arrest a number of protesters. More than 1,000 people protested in the city over a government bill that would give police new powers to restrict street protests. The latest rally was the third demonstration against the bill since last week. Police said some protesters threw projectiles at security forces. The proposed legislation has angered activists, particularly after a heavy-handed police response to a London vigil for murder victim Sarah Everard on March 13th. Police have faced widespread outrage and criticism because of their response to the vigil. A school in northern England is in the center of a media firestorm after suspending a teacher for insulting Islam's Prophet Muhammad. The school apologized to parents after a protest. However, many are unhappy with the school's reaction, claiming that Muslims are breaching freedom of speech. Robert Carter was at Bateley to find out more.
In the English town of Batley, a local grammar school has caused major controversy after a teacher showed a blasphemous cartoon of Islam's Holy Prophet Muhammad to students during a religious studies class. Outraged parents of Muslim students began protesting outside the school gates on Thursday, demanding the school take action against Islamophobia.
The incident from Monday, 22nd of March, must also be investigated from a criminal perspective,
yes,
given that it was a clear attempt to stir up religious hatred. We also use this opportunity to call upon the entire British Muslim community to review the materials being taught in their children's schools.
Batley Grammar School reacted quickly, suspending the teacher, launching an investigation, and apologizing to parents. However, the British press and politicians have opted to condemn the protesters instead, adding further fuel to the fire.
I was disturbed to see scenes of people protesting outside the school. That is not right. We shouldn't have teachers, members of the staff of schools feeling intimidated.
The creator of the universe, Allah, the most merciful, doesn't need a crowd hanging around outside the school.
Many details about what the protesters have been demanding are not clear. Press TV spoke to locals to find out more.
As far as I know, the parents have been very, very responsible. I mean, many of the protesters are not even
parents, and the parents have acted very responsibly, very, very professionally, and they should be commended. You know, they're the basically the victims of this situation, but they're also the stars of this situation, that they've basically acted in a calm, collective manner. They've not made any unreasonable demands to the school. They've not asked for anything untoward to happen towards the teacher. They've been very, very responsible, and they should be commended for their stance and for their actions.
The school has acknowledged that the resource used in Monday's lesson was completely inappropriate and had the potential to cause considerable offence within the community. However, many online are now arguing that Muslims need to accept insults on the Holy Prophet as part of freedom of speech, and if they don't like it, they have to essentially lump it. However, with further Muslim action planned elsewhere in the country, and also the media continuing to hype up the story, it's likely that things will continue to escalate going forward. Robert Carter, Batley.
Well, we're going to go back to our top story for this half hour, where at least 16 people have been killed as fresh clashes erupt between Myanmar security forces and anti-coup protesters. Joining us on the line from Yangon, we have director of the Tampa Deepa Institute, Mr. Kin Zhao Nguyen. Mr. Nguyen, welcome to the program. Please give us your perspective on the political turbulence that we're seeing right now in Myanmar.
Thank you. Well, it's going on, you know. The protests against the coup have been going on for nearly 2 months, you know, and no side shows signs of relenting. People are getting killed every day. Even kids as young as 7. So why? What do we do with a regime like this, a junta like this, that's quite ready to shoot its own people, even children, to maintain its grip on power? No, it's not about political values or political gains or anything. It's about basic values, you know? What are you going to do to resolve the situation? Are you going to kill more and more people just to maintain your grip on power?
So what's the way forward, in your opinion, Mr. Nguyen? Do you think the international community should get more involved at this point?
Well, certainly. Well, I personally have not depended on the international community, especially the United Nations, you know, but the 9 people in the streets, they call for R2P and UN intervention and all that. I feel very sorry for them, you know. Well, at least the European Union and the United States have responded with sanctions and calls for release of the people and for downgrading of the violence. But it's falling on deaf ears. Please, if I may, let me just one point. We are dealing with a very brutal and recalcitrant and a regime that knows no bounds, doesn't recognize anything in the way of international regulations and conventions. So it's a very primitive standoff, you know, the unarmed people against a brutal, well-armed security forces that don't care about people's lives. It's really desperate.
Thanks a lot. Kin Zhao Nguyen joining us on the line from Yangon. Elsewhere, Yemen is marking the 6th anniversary of the Saudi-led war, which has left the country broken. And on the edge of famine, the grinding conflict has sparked what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with some two-thirds of the population in need of aid. We have the details in this following report.
The Saudi-led coalition intervened in Yemen militarily in March 2015 to restore to power former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi. During the years, the Saudi war machine has pounded the poorest Arab nation non-stop. To make matters worse, Saudi Arabia has imposed a blockade on the country, which has badly hampered efforts to save civilian lives. The UN regards the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN Humanitarian Office puts the Yemen war dead at 233,000. The toll includes 131,000 from indirect causes, such as a lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. According to the World Food Program, out of the 29 million population, over 20 million depend on some form of aid for survival. 4 million have been driven from their homes, more than 16 million face hunger this year, and the rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world. Nearly half of Yemeni children under the age of 5 suffer from acute malnutrition. After 6 years of relentless violence, the kingdom has failed to bring allied politicians back to power. Political commentator Tim Anderson believes Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its objectives in Yemen.
The Saudis, as the spearhead of that, if you like, have not achieved any of their objectives. They've been on retreat for some time now, and as your report points out, the Yemenis are pressing their advantage now that they have the upper hand.
Now, Saudi Arabia is coming under growing pressure from the international community to end the war. The new U.S. administration claims it's halted its support for the Saudi-led war, saying there is no military solution. Some European powers have also stopped or suspended arms sales to Riyadh. In the meantime, the Yemeni army launched a major drone and ballistic missile attack against the kingdom's oil infrastructure and military bases. The Saudi-led coalition is also facing intense pressure from a Yemeni offensive on the northern province of Marib. The attacks have dramatically upped the ante for the Saudis, making them feel more than ever the bitter pinch of the war. Political analyst Colin Cavill says the Yemenis have demonstrated the desire and capacity to be free from the decade-long Saudi hegemony.
The Yemeni people have already demonstrated their desire to be free, of the Saudi puppets.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has vowed the Yemenis will remain steadfast in resisting the Saudi-led war. Abdul Malik Badreddin al-Houthi has stressed they will continue dealing blows to the Saudis on their own soil as long as the war continues. Riyadh appears to be searching for a way out without having to offer any concession. This week, Saudis offered what they called a comprehensive ceasefire, but Yemenis rejected the proposal as nothing new. They say their attacks won't stop until Saudi Arabia stops its aggression and lifts the air and sea blockade on the country. It remains to be seen if the Saudis will find a face-saving path to exit the military quagmire before the 7th anniversary of the war.
Well, a collision between two trains in Egypt has killed at least 32 people and injured scores of others. The crash happened in the province of Sohag, south of the capital, Cairo. Medical reinforcements, including more than 100 ambulances, have been dispatched to the crash site. Technicians are also trying to remove five dislocated and damaged train wagons. President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has pledged tough punishment for those responsible for the crash. Crumbling infrastructure and poor maintenance is blamed to be the main cause of the crash. That's a wrap for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nauru's special. Just as spring revives and regenerates nature, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, breathes new spirit into the corpse of society and revives it. He revives the dead souls and ignorant humans with knowledge and awareness. When he reappears, the public culture advances in human society and corruption is uprooted. People will become very kind and sympathetic to one another. There won't be such phrases like, "That's your problem." Everyone will feel responsibility towards the problems of others. In short, everyone will consider another one's problem as his own problem. The Almighty has created the world in a way that is dominated by human beings so that he can make the best use of it. The merciful God has put the spring beauties and bounties in the control of all. Faithful and the faithless, pious and impious are all benefiting from these bounties. Spring is God's public spread. God says in verse 50, of Surah Rum in the Holy Quran, "So observe the effects of Allah's mercy, how he revives the earth after its death. Indeed, he has power over all things." Spring is the manifestation of God's all-encompassing mercy. Basically, taking pleasure is one of the features of human being. He or she takes pleasure in eating, drinking, talking with friends, and so on. Islam emphasizes that a believer should do his or her work with pleasure. Now spring has arrived with all of its beauties. It is we who should not pass by these beauties carelessly. We should rather ponder on them, to be admonished. We must thank God for these bounties. According to religious teachings, being thankful of God will materialize by using his bounties in the correct way. Islam is not opposed to pleasure. It advises human beings to enjoy God's bounties in the best way possible and take pleasure with every bounty. But it prevents us from forbidden pleasures, which are not real pleasures. Forbidden or illegitimate pleasures are the ones that harm either the individual or other individuals. They are harmful both in this world and in the hereafter. God says in verse 32 of Surah A'raf in the Holy Quran, addressing the Prophet, the Almighty says, "Say, who has forbidden the adornment of Allah, which He has brought forth for His servants, and the good things of provision? Say, these are for the faithful in the life of this world, and exclusively for them on the day of resurrection. Thus do we elaborate the signs for a people who have knowledge." In fact, the Holy Quran deplores trivial and transient pleasures and underlines permanent ones. In view of a faithful person, there is no pleasure superior to God's satisfaction. That's why he or she strives to attain God's satisfaction in every deed. The Almighty says in verse 17 of Surah Allah in the Holy Quran that the hereafter is better and more lasting. So there are two criteria for evaluation. One points to the quality and the other points to quantity. The faithful who contemplate on the divine bounties and believe in God's promise wait for the coming of the promised Savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance. The Almighty says in verse 96 of Surah A'raf in the Holy Quran, "If the people of the towns had been faithful and God-weary, we would have opened to them the blessings from the heavens and the earth." The day of Imam Mahdi's reappearance will mark the start of the Almighty sending down special bounties and blessings. When he comes, the heavens will give their bounties more generously to human beings. Then human beings will enjoy these bounties in the way of worship and servitude of God. As we recite in the supplication, iftitah or opening supplication, in the nights of the blessed month of Ramadan, the rule of Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, is the noble government, or Dawlat-e-Kalimah. It is during that rule that mankind will enjoy the true meaning of dignity and humane values under the divine laws. We all pray to God to expedite the reappearance of the awaited Savior of mankind, the last infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, the Imam of the age, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance. According to a narration, if the entire knowledge of mankind was 27 parts, only 2 parts will be known and discovered till the coming of Imam Mahdi. True knowledge and cognizance of God will materialize during his era.
Yemenis have staged rallies to mark the 6th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country. This day is regarded as the National Day of Resilience against the Saudi-led aggression. The war has left Yemen devastated and on the brink of famine, claiming tens of thousands of lives, displacing millions. Saudi Arabia has also imposed a blockade on Yemen, which has badly hampered humanitarian efforts. The UN says the impoverished Arab nation is facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In the past few weeks, the Yemeni army has launched major drone and ballistic missile attacks on Saudi Arabia's sensitive targets. The main question now, why has Saudi Arabia failed to achieve any of its objectives in Yemen over the past 6 years of its destructive war?
The Saudi-led coalition intervened in Yemen militarily in March 2015 to restore to power former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi. During the years, the Saudi war machine has pounded the poorest Arab nation non-stop. To make matters worse, Saudi Arabia has imposed a blockade on the country, which has badly hampered efforts to save civilian lives. The UN regards the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN Humanitarian Office puts the Yemen war dead at 233,000. The toll includes 131,000 from indirect causes, such as a lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. According to the World Food Program, out of the 29 million population, over 20 million depend on some form of aid for survival. 4 million have been driven from their homes, more than 16 million face hunger this year, and the rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world. Nearly half of Yemeni children under the age of 5 suffer from acute malnutrition. After 6 years of relentless violence, the kingdom has failed to bring allied politicians back to power. Political commentator Tim Anderson believes Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its objectives in Yemen.
The Saudis, as the spearhead of that, if you like, have not achieved any of their objectives. They've been on retreat for some time now, and as your report points out, that's the Yemenis are pressing their advantage now that they have the upper hand.
Now, Saudi Arabia is coming under growing pressure from the international community to end the war. The new U.S. administration claims it's halted its support for the Saudi-led war, saying there is no military solution. Some European powers have also stopped or suspended arms sales to Riyadh. In the meantime, the Yemeni army launched a major drone and ballistic missile attack against the kingdom's oil infrastructure and military bases. The Saudi-led coalition is also facing intense pressure from a Yemeni offensive on the northern province of Marib. The attacks have dramatically upped the ante for the Saudis, making them feel more than ever the bitter pinch of the war. Political analyst Colin Cavill says the Yemenis have demonstrated the desire and capacity to be free from the decade-long Saudi hegemony.
The Yemeni people have already demonstrated their desire to be free of the Saudi puppets.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has vowed the Yemenis will remain steadfast in resisting the Saudi-led war. Abdul Malik Badreddin al-Houthi has stressed they will continue dealing blows to the Saudis on their own soil as long as the war continues. Riyadh appears to be searching for a way out without having to offer any concession. This week, Saudis offered what they called a comprehensive ceasefire, but Yemenis rejected the proposal as nothing new. They say their attacks won't stop until Saudi Arabia stops its aggression and lifts the air and sea blockade on the country. It remains to be seen if the Saudis will find a face-saving path to exit the military quagmire before the 7th anniversary of the war.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have international human rights lawyer Daniel Kovala joining us from Pittsburgh, also from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, Mr. Ken Stone, joining us from Hamilton. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Kovalik in Pittsburgh. The war has destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure and led to a famine, the worst famine to occur in 100 years, according to the United Nations, in addition to other epidemics in the impoverished country of Yemen. Why has this war been dragged out for so long?
Well, it's dragged out for so long because the Saudis have totally underestimated the capacity and the will of the Yemeni people to resist. Despite the fact that the Yemenis, as you say, have been suffering greatly through the bombardment, the U.S.-backed, we have to say that, bombardment, through the blockade, they have stood firm. And you saw pictures today of thousands and thousands of people rallying in Yemen, celebrating the fact that they have not been defeated by what should have been a greater power in Saudi Arabia against a Saudi Arabia-backed by the U.S., the U.K., and Israel. This is David having whooped Goliath's ass, okay? And the Saudis are reeling from it. And the Yemenis have proven they will fight until the last person. And it's frankly quite stunning. And the Saudis are stunned by this.
Let's bring in Mr. Ken Stone from Hamilton. Mr. Stone, if none of Riyadh's objectives have been met, does it mean that the Saudis are worse off now more than ever over the course of the 6 years of the war?
Yes, indeed. But first, I'd like to congratulate Press TV for covering the war, the Saudi war of aggression against Yemen, so diligently for the past 6 years. Unlike the mass media in the West here, which have chosen to ignore the war, and that's mainly because they don't want the people in the West to realize the havoc that has been wrought upon the people of Yemen by the arms that are being sold in the countries of the West to Saudi Arabia. So kudos to Press TV, and I believe you're living up to your motto of being the voice for the voiceless. Now, to answer the question, the Saudis are indeed worse off. They are losing this war, and they are losing it badly. They are stunned, as my colleague Dan Kovalik just said. And this is not the only war they're losing. They are losing the war in Syria, which they also funded and recruited for. And this has cost the Saudi economy hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars. Saudi Arabia was, until recently, one of the richest countries in the world, with money to burn on real estate in London and in the United States and all kinds of fancy jets and everything else. But now they are in deficit. Now they are in debt. And you can't expect to run a country when you lose two wars. I think it's the defeat, the debacle of losing two wars is going to put the Saudi royal family in jeopardy. It might mean the fall of the House of Saud, which could not come too soon, in my estimation.
Danny Kovalik, the United Nations says that Yemen is speeding towards the worst famine on the planet. Top UN officials have also warned that this massive famine could wipe out the fresh peace efforts, so-called peace efforts, with 16 million people going hungry across Yemen. Yet we're still witnessing international inaction to relieve the suffering of the Yemeni people. Why is that?
Because those that pull the strings, like the U.S. and the U.K. and Israel, are happy with what's happening to Yemen. They are supporting Saudi Arabia in this effort, and they are silencing people who oppose it. And as my colleague Ken said, the mass media is complicit in this. They don't report on it. Most of the world doesn't know that this war is happening, doesn't know the depths of this famine. But it has to be pointed out that when history is written about this, those who participated in this war against Yemen, which includes Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, will go down with the names of other people like Pol Pot in terms of starving out people. This is a disgrace. This is an evil that must stop. And that is why, again, few people talk about it, because they will not face the reality of what's happening.
Mr. Stone, on the sixth anniversary of the war, the Yemeni army launched a major drone and ballistic missile attack on Saudi Arabia. Drones and missiles targeted Aramco oil facilities in four cities. Military bases and positions were also hit as well. Talk to us about the significance of these retaliatory attacks that are being carried out by the Yemenis. Does it show how far the Saudis are from the goals that they'd set out on the onset of the war?
It absolutely does show how far the Saudis are from the goals they set out at the onset of this war. They seriously underestimated the Yemeni people, whose aim is to have self-determination. This is a popular uprising which started back in 2014, I believe, to remove the Saudi-dominated government of Yemen. And when the Houthi people managed to overthrow this domination of the richest country in the Middle East over the poorest country in the Middle East, the Saudis responded by working with the U.S., the U.K., Israel, Canada, and many other countries, United Arab Emirates, to try and put an end to this popular uprising. And at first, I remember pictures shown on Press TV of barefoot Yemeni soldiers driving captured columns of Saudi Arabian coalition soldiers into camps after having defeated them in battle. And now the resilience of the Yemeni people, which the Saudis seriously underestimated as well, has turned into Yemeni attacks in the heartland of Saudi Arabia with drones right on their pocketbooks, hitting their petroleum facilities and their military bases right around Riyadh. It's astonishing how far the Yemeni people, who started as barefoot soldiers, have advanced in this war. The Saudis are stunned by their oncoming defeat.
Danny Kowalik, how much can these reprisal attacks change the dynamics of the war? Did the Saudis underestimate the defensive capabilities of the Yemeni forces, in your opinion?
Well, yes. And what history has shown is that when colonial or neo-colonial powers like Saudi Arabia, backed by, of course, the big colonial powers, attempt to subdue a population, despite the fact that they may have much superior air power and other military might, they generally are unable to do it. I mean, a good comparison, of course, is Vietnam, where the U.S. thought that it could defeat the Vietnamese, and every day they thought they were on the verge of victory, when in fact that victory never came. Of course, the Vietnamese defeated the French, and then the United States, and then China, and overthrew Pol Pot. I mean, you can't subdue a people for very long, and the Saudis have discovered this. And they will keep discovering this as long as they keep this war up. And I think at some point, the U.S. is going to cut Saudi Arabia loose because, the alliance between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is not really a natural one. We don't have much in common except that oil. And if the Yemenis keep hurting Saudi Arabia's ability to get that oil out of the ground, the U.S. will have no use for Saudi Arabia anymore.
Ken Stone, do you agree with those comments? Skeptics believe that maybe Biden, who is an old wolf of U.S. foreign policy, isn't going to let down the U.S.-backed dictatorships in the Middle East that they've armed and supported for so long. What do you think?
I think that Saudi Arabia was one of the three pillars of U.S. hegemony over the oil-rich Middle East until 1979, when the Iran Revolution took place. Iran was one of the other pillars, and the State of Israel is the third. So Saudi Arabia could not have waged this war against Yemen without the green light from the U.S. And when Biden says that he doesn't want Saudi offensive attacks to continue on Yemen, if he really wanted this war to end, he would just turn the green light to a red light and say, stop the war now. But he hasn't done so. He said they're putting a hold on arms sales, but in fact there was a big arms sale by, I think Lockheed Martin just last month, of millions of dollars worth of equipment. And the U.S. Is not taking the position that the peace movement around the world wants to see it take. Today is the global day of action to stop the war on Yemen. It's actually the second global day. There was a first global day on January 25th, and that was the biggest anti-war mobilization since Iraq. Today, people are demonstrating in many countries. In Canada, we had a car cavalcade here in Hamilton, Ontario, and in Vancouver yesterday. Right now in London, Ontario, People are sitting on the railway tracks into the General Dynamics plant, where the light armored vehicles worth $15 billion are being sold from Canada to Saudi Arabia. It's time that that the grassroots, that the peace movement, that the people of the world tell their governments, especially in the countries which are participating in and fueling this war with arms sales, that it's time to stop these arms sales. And that can help to be a factor in stopping this war, just as my colleague Dan Kovalik said about the war in Vietnam. The demonstrations around the world, the peace movement, helped to bring that war to an end. And today, the global peace movement is on the move.
Right.
And hopefully, it will help too.
Daniel Kovalik, reacting to Joe Biden's comments about wanting to stop support for the Yemeni war, Yemen's Supreme Political Council said the Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements, and they want to see action. Why should the Yemenis even trust Washington?
Well, they shouldn't. I mean, there's no reason to. They've now lived into the third presidency of the United States that has backed this war. And, you know, it's particularly hypocritical that someone like President Obama and President Biden, who claim to be, you know, people who support human rights and liberty and all that, that they have been as supportive of this conflict as Donald Trump. This has been a bipartisan war. There is no reason to trust the United States here. Again, in the end, if the U.S. backs out of this war, it will be because, as Ken said, the people of the world have demanded it, but also because the Yemenis have forced the U.S.'s hand. That is the only thing that will stop the backing of Saudi Arabia.
Ken Stone, in a statement issued during today's rallies, Yemenis stressed they reserve the right to pursue criminal charges against their attackers. As we know, Yemeni officials have in the past called for war crimes probes. Will there be accountability for the crimes committed against the Yemeni people? How likely is that going to happen, given all the support Washington gives to Riyadh?
Unfortunately, it's not likely, because the international criminal tribunals that have been held in the past on Yugoslavia and Rwanda, other international issues, are paid for and organized by the main neocolonial powers, the EU and the US. So I'm not optimistic. Nonetheless, they should try anyway. And they should further see if they can force reparations from those countries that have participated directly in the Saudi-led coalition against the people of Yemen, and the countries that have sold arms to fuel this war, such as the governments of Canada, the U.S., the U.K., and other European countries.
And one last question for Mr. Kovalik, an issue that Mr. Stone brought up earlier. UNICEF has warned of the formation of a lost generation in Yemen. Well over 500,000 children have been forced to leave their homes as a result of this war. That's also coupled with the destruction that the Yemeni infrastructure has taken. Why is all of this being underreported in the mainstream media?
It's being underreported because those facts are quite inconvenient to the idea of American exceptionalism that most people in the U.S. and certainly most people in the media hold dearly to. And that is the idea that somehow the U.S. is this unique force for good in the world, that the U.S. military is basically a human rights organization in their view. And what's happening in Yemen totally belies that belief system. What you're seeing in Yemen exposes the brutality of U.S. foreign policy, and again, will put the U.S. Along the ranks of other criminal nations that have carried out aggressive wars. And again, as the statistics are showing, this may be one of the most brutal wars we have ever seen in modern times against largely the civilian population of Yemen. It is a disgrace that the media just cannot get its head around.
All right. Thanks, gentlemen. International human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, thanks to Mr. Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to stop the war, and also special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو ذا الرحمن. Allah هو ذا المنان. لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear listeners, wherever you are, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer the questions with regard to theology or whatever goes towards religion and the beliefs of people, specifically the followers of the School of Ahlul Bayt, in order to discuss these issues with scholars from seminary schools. We have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to this session. I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikhna. The question that we want to touch upon today in this very show is concerning a question received by a respected questioner concerning the Quran as a divine book. And the questioner wants to say, actually, implicitly, that Quran cannot be a divine book. The reason that this respected questioner refers to is that the questioner says that since there is no sign of, or no, let's say, trace of snow, or let's say, polar animals, and on the other hand, there is no sign of tropical fruits in Quran, it shows that this book cannot be a divine book. We have already seen some questions like these, that they actually refer and resort to other signs or to other things to adhere to this claim that Quran cannot be a comprehensive book since it lacks this and that, blah and blah. To my own understanding, we cannot find a divine book mentioning all the words that comes to our mind or what all we see. And even it cannot be a good proof for a divine book to include all the words and to talk about everything on the scene of earth or in the heavens and the skies. So why this respected questioner wants to know about these specific things, for example, the mentioning the name or a trace of snow or polar animals and so, it does not necessarily mean that Quran is not a divine book. We have also heard that, for example, there is no full history of those, for example, nation, and there is no trace of other generations. Again, are among the signs that Quran cannot be a divine book. But in order to answer this question scientifically, we have again invited respected speaker, respected researcher, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools, to help us answer this question in detail. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks to you, Sheikh. The question and questions like this question, actually, we have heard a lot in our life and within discussions with people. But what can be first a brief answer and second a detailed answer to this? Because I want to make the person equipped with a brief answer first, then a detailed answer to this and these sorts of questions.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think you refer to the brief answer, the fact that Quran is not a dictionary, it's not an encyclopedia, I mean, mentioning all the names in all the languages and bringing a definition for them. So if there is no tropical fruit mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran, there are many, many other fruits not mentioned in the Quran. So you can find few fruits mentioned in the Quran. There are many more which are not mentioned. When it comes to the other, physical phenomena, there are many, many which are not mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran. So if you want to contain in a book all the names which are used by different people in different parts of the world, you need, maybe 10 volumes or 100 volumes only to mention the names and the definitions.
True.
So from this perspective, the question seems to weird. But I think the point is that some of these people who pose this question, they want to say that the fruits which are mentioned in the Quran, the animals mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran, and the rewards mentioned in the Quran are only for the Arabs of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why the accuracy of the Quran